This is a recording of the Robert Greenstein Conference with the Center on Budget and Policy on December 6th, 2012 at 10 a.m. Central Time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. We now have your presenters in conference. Please be aware, each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open all lines for questions. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's first presenter, Mr. Robert Greenstein.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. As you know, we're going to talk this morning about whether one could cap itemized deductions for high-income households as an alternative to letting the Bush tax cuts on incomes above $250,000 expire at the end of the year. I'm very pleased that with us is Peter Orszag. Peter really needs no introduction, as I'm sure you all know. He's the former director of the Congressional Budget Office, the former director of the Office of Management and Budget. He's now vice chairman at Citigroup. He's also a Bloomberg View columnist, where he had a column on November 27th on the issue we're going to be talking about this morning. In addition, the Center on Budget issued a paper on this that's on our website. We issued the paper on November 29th, and the authors of the paper, the Center's tax team, will be joining us for the discussion in the question and answer that follow my remarks and then Peter's remarks. So, as you know, some people have suggested, some policymakers have suggested, capping deductions as an alternative to letting the high income tax cuts expire. In a nutshell, there are two serious problems with that suggestion. The first is, as I'll explain, in the real world, the savings from a deduction limitation would fall far short of the revenue raised by letting the high income tax cuts expire. And secondly, if policymakers really want to get to the $4 trillion deficit reduction level they often talk about, they're going to need significantly more than $1 trillion from revenues, and that means that savings from tax deductions and possibly other tax expenditures will need to supplement rather than substitute for the savings from letting the high income tax cuts expire. Let me take these two issues one at a time, and these points are covered in more detail in the Center's paper. So, President Obama has called for letting the Bush tax cuts expire on people above $250,000 for singles, $250,000 for couples, $200,000 for singles, and restoring the estate tax to its 2009 parameters. Those proposals raise about $968 billion in revenue over 10 years relative to simply extending all of the current tax policies due to expire. Now, can you get something close to that on the deduction side? Well, the first point is if one wanted to design a deduction policy that brought in, say, $950 billion, and it were just a general deduction policy, then it would inevitably mean that a not insignificant share of the $950 billion would come from people under $250,000 a year, which in turn would mean that relative to letting the high income tax cuts expire, one was shifting some of the tax burden somewhat down the income scale. For this reason, discussions of deduction limitations often move to discussions of a deduction limit that applies to people above $250,000. Okay, if you look at the Tax Policy Center's figures, you find that to raise $950 billion from limiting tax deductions for people above $250,000 a year, $200,000 for singles, you have to entirely eliminate, not cap, but entirely eliminate all deductions for that group. That's what the Tax Policy Center numbers indicate. Now, that would produce a policy that policymakers wouldn't and shouldn't pass. First, it's very difficult to see policymakers entirely eliminating the deductions. Secondly, whether you eliminated deductions or you had a cap at $25,000 a year or $50,000 a year, if you try to simply start it at $250,000 you would create a massive increase in effective tax rates right at the 250,000 point. Policymakers wouldn't do that. You would have to phase in your deduction cap or deduction elimination, say between 250,000 and 400,000 a year, or 250,000 and 500,000 a year, but that would lose a lot of the savings. In addition, and Peter is going to talk more about this, a deduction cap or a deduction limitation would mean that for very large numbers of high-income people, one was essentially zeroing out tax incentives for charitable giving. That wouldn't be sound policy, and it wouldn't fly politically. One could exempt itemized deductions for charitable contributions. That would lose a lot more of the savings. Then there are other issues as well related to the economic recovery and possibly fairness. The housing market is recovering, but it's still weak. We estimate that filers with incomes over 250 claimed roughly $15 billion in mortgage interest deductions in 2011. What would the housing industry say about withdrawing that subsidy right now, given the current state of the housing market? It's hard to believe that if policymakers wanted to go there, they would apply it immediately, starting at the beginning of 2013. And then further questions would likely be raised about, if you change the deduction policy, should it apply to existing mortgages or only new mortgages? This is why when the administration has looked at deduction limitation proposals, its estimate is that they probably wouldn't save more than somewhere in the ballpark of $300 to $400 billion, and that estimate is consistent with our analysis. Now, my second point was that we're going to need more revenue, not simply the amount, from letting the high-income tax cuts expire. Policymakers of both parties often say they want $4 trillion in deficit reduction. If you want to get to $4 trillion, counting what we've already done, the changes in 2011 culminating in the Budget Control Act, save about $1.5 trillion in discretionary spending relative to where we were under the CBO baseline at the start of 2011. But if you want to get to $4 trillion total, it's very difficult to see how one gets there without substantially over $1 trillion in revenues. Why is that? Well, let's look at the spending categories from which savings could come. Non-defense discretionary, healthcare entitlements, non-healthcare entitlements. Okay, let's start with discretionary. Neither party seems to have much stomach for going much farther, if at all, in defense, which is already contributing under the BCA caps somewhere in the vicinity of $500 billion over 10 years. Well, what about non-defense discretionary? Well, under the BCA caps, and I'm not counting sequestration here, this is just the caps without sequestration. Under the caps, non-defense discretionary spending will, by 2017, reach its lowest level as a share of the economy since 1962. And the caps are even tighter than that factoid might imply. They're even tighter because there are some areas of non-defense discretionary that are going to require substantial increases, which Congress will surely provide over the next 10 years, such as veterans health care. Veterans health care is going to need more than $250 billion in increases over the next 10 years to provide health care for aging Vietnam veterans, veterans of which there still are a significant number from Korea, and a mounting number of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. These reasons are why Alice Rivlin and Pete Domenici, in testimony a few months ago on the Hill, said that Congress could not responsibly go farther in the discretionary area than the Budget Control Act caps. Okay, what about non-health care entitlements? This was the area of least controversy in the various budgetary negotiations in 2011 from the Biden negotiations through the Super Committee. The two parties tentatively had worked out agreement on about $250 billion in savings here, and perhaps such an amount is achievable again now. There's one wrinkle, which is some of that $250 billion has since been enacted as offsets for other bills in the intervening year and a half. But let's assume you could get $250 billion thereabouts there. Okay, we now move to health care entitlements. In the long run, much bigger savings are going to need to come from the health care area. We have to slow the rate of growth of health care system-wide. But over the next 10 years, it's very hard to see how one gets big savings from the Medicaid program. Medicaid already costs and pays 20 to 25% less per beneficiary than private insurance, significantly less than Medicare as well. Its beneficiaries are poor. You can't put big premium and cost-sharing increases on them. And you can't exactly shift large costs to states at the very time you are asking states to address the single biggest hole in the U.S. safety net, the fact that millions of poor Americans aren't insured because they can't afford it. The Affordable Care Act deals with that through its Medicaid expansion, but that's a state option. States have to decide whether to take it, and it's very difficult to ask them to take the Medicaid expansion while you're shifting all sorts of new costs to them. In the area of Medicare, we saw in the presidential campaign and the debates, neither party is interested in moving aggressively to substantially increase costs for current beneficiaries. Even most of the more aggressive Medicare proposals don't start for a number of years and then phase in over a couple of decades. Moreover, if you take the president's budget, his single largest Medicare saver, which we think is excellent policy, is a proposal that would save $137 billion over 10 years, but has a near zero chance of making it through the Congress. This is a proposal to require that the prices that Medicare pays for drugs for low-income beneficiaries be reduced so that they match the very same the prices that the Medicaid program pays for the very same drugs. Eminently reasonable proposal. Everyone I talk to on the Hill says there's not a snowball's chance of getting that past the power of pharma and the pharmaceutical lobby. So it's going to be a big struggle just to get to, say, $400 billion in Medicare savings. Maybe Congress will alter the cost of living adjustment formula for benefit programs. Maybe it won't, but the savings in the first 10 years aren't that big there. Bottom line is it's really hard to get even close to $1 trillion in spending. So, very difficult to make the numbers add up unless you're substantially over $1 trillion on the revenue side, which again brings one to the conclusion that tax expenditure savings should supplement rather than substitute for the savings from letting the high-income tax cuts expire. Two quick facts, and then I'll turn it over to Peter. Fact number one, it's instructive to look at the Bowles-Simpson report issued in December 2010 that actually had $2.6 trillion in revenue increases. Now, a number of you may say, I never heard such a high figure for Bowles-Simpson. Bowles-Simpson printed a smaller number, but the reason the number looked smaller is that it assumed the $950 billion in savings from letting the high-income Bush tax cuts expire and reinstating the 2009 estate tax rules in its baseline. Policymakers are now using a different baseline, one that starts from the current, all of the current Bush tax cuts and the current estate tax parameters. And once you measure from the baseline everyone is now using, it turns out that the Bowles-Simpson revenue provisions would raise $2.6 trillion over the 2013 through 2022 period. Finally, I think it's worth noting that in its analysis of the impact on the economy, the Congressional Budget Office concluded that the difference in the impact on the economy between extending all of the Bush tax cuts and extending the tax cuts on incomes up to 250 but not over, that the difference is all of 0.1 percentage point of GDP. No significant economic impact. With that, let me turn it over to Peter Orszag.
Thank you, Bob. I will actually be pretty brief since I think Bob covered things fairly well, and then we'll be able to leave more of our time for your questions. So let me just make two comments very briefly about the proposals to limit itemized deductions. One of the reasons why some of these proposals, like a $50,000 cap, remain, in my opinion, artificially attractive at this point is their vagueness. No one knows exactly what deductions get scaled back under that kind of approach as opposed to attacking or changing the provisions directly. But that attractiveness is misleading. If you look at the $50,000 itemized deduction cap as just one example, households above $200,000 in income who have average deductions of $50,000 or more, which is not surprising, that's where it's disproportionately, although not exclusively binding. They claimed pre-principal deductions by dollar value. The most recent data that we have access to from the IRS is 2009. 90% of the dollar value of the deductions claimed by those households in 2009 came from just three sources: mortgage interest deduction, taxes paid, which in turn is mostly state and local taxes, and then finally charitable contributions. So that's really where the bulk of the hit will come. And if you think about a household, there's not very much you can do to affect your state and local taxes or your mortgage without moving or refinancing, but in particular without moving. And so the thing that's the most discretionary out of those big three is charitable. So let's take a quick look at that. In 2009, those households claimed on their itemized deductions approximately $60 billion in charitable contributions, which amounted to roughly 20% of all giving in the United States from bequests, from corporations, from individuals that year. So it's a significant amount of the base for the nonprofit sector. The economics literature suggests that in response to a dollar reduction in the tax break, that charitable giving tends to fall by somewhere between 50 cents and a dollar. There was actually just a very good article in the spring 2011 edition of the Journal of Economic Perspectives by John List, who is a professor at the University of Chicago, walking through some of that literature, if anyone's interested in looking that up. In any case, what that suggests is that you would be talking about tens of billions of dollars in reduced giving to nonprofit and charitable sectors, right when those sectors are starting to get back on their feet following the financial crisis, and when in various areas they are still struggling significantly. I mean, the thought, for example, I'm sitting in New York right now, the thought that NYU Hospital, which suffered roughly $1 billion of damage during the hurricane, much of which is not insured, the thought that they will succeed in their rehabilitation project with in a context in which the tax preference is eliminated for most of their major donors at the margin is a challenging prospect indeed. And that's why you're seeing, I think, increased attention. There was an article in the New York Times this morning about the charitable sector revving up after recognizing the threat from this kind of proposal. And I guess the point just is that it's easy to say, it's a lot harder to do things like that and actually get them through the legislative process. One response, of course, as Bob mentioned, is you could just carve out charitable contributions and not count them towards the itemized deduction limit, but then the Tax Policy Center estimate suggests that the $50,000 cap revenue impact falls from a little bit north of $700 billion to something more like $400, so there's a very significant impact from carving that out. And then you're still left with the challenges for the housing sector and for state and local governments that would come from that kind of pared back proposal. So it's very clear that changing tax expenditures should be part of the solution, but as Bob said, I think to lean on it for its entirety, especially when we're vague about what the impact is, which is what most of these proposals that have an aggregate cap entail, is not realistic when you think about the underlying legislative dynamic. final point I want to make is I think it's widely appreciated that the system of tax expenditures that we have are inefficient and that there are changes that are warranted. So I want to make it clear that it would be beneficial as part of the budget negotiations to have reform and revenue that comes from scaling back those tax expenditures. But the right way to do that is to transform the tax expenditures into credits. Lily Batchelder and Fred Goldberg and I laid out the economic efficiency argument for doing so in a Stanford Law Review article a few years ago. But the basic intuition is there are all sorts of things that we try to encourage through the tax code, whether it's charitable giving or home ownership, and so on and so forth. It makes no sense whatsoever, not just from a fairness perspective, but from an economic efficiency perspective, for the per dollar tax break to vary with your marginal tax rate, which is what happens when these tax breaks take the form of deductions or exclusions. So if I pay a dollar in mortgage interest and I'm a 35% or 39.6% taxpayer, that person saves 35 to 40 cents on the dollar. Someone in the 15% marginal tax bracket saves 15 cents on the dollar. And unless of per dollar of mortgage interest, and unless you believe that the social benefits from the high marginal tax rate household are 2 to 3 times the social benefits of the middle income household, that doesn't make any sense even from an efficiency perspective. So there is a whole series of things that could be done. The administration's proposal to limit itemized deductions and exclusions to 28% is, I think, more spiritually aligned with that thought than just a $50,000 or similar cap is. But the bottom line is scaling back tax expenditures could be part of the solution, not all of the solution. And if we are going to scale back tax expenditures, there are more and less efficient ways of doing it. The $50,000 cap type of approach is a much less efficient way of doing it.